Chapter 7. The Nameless Fortress. War Council. The Gift. Loken stepped onto the cold embarkation deck of the orbital fortress, fixed 100 kilometres above Titan's surface, and swathed in the darkness of its night side, the bleak station spun gently above an active cryovolcano. Rasua had flown the Tarnelm onto its embarkation deck with a light hand at the controls, her every orspex warning that she was bracketed by lethal ordnance. Vapour rose from the void-cold flanks of the Tarnelm, and Loken sweated in his armour. The deck was enormous, with space enough for great prison barks to disgorge their human cargo and the custodians of the fortress to render them. A squad of mortal warriors in gloss-red armour and silver-visored helms awaited him at the base of the ramp, but Loken ignored them in favour of the broadly built veterans standing before them. Armoured identically to Loken, the warriors' deeply tanned and deeper-lined face were well known to him. White hair, kept close-cropped, and a neat beard of the same hue made him look old. Pale eyes, that had seen too much, were even older.
"Loken," said Yakton Cruz, his voice little more than a whisper. "It's good to see you, lad."
"Cruz," replied Loken, coming forward to take the old warrior's hand. The grip was firm, unyielding, as if Cruz were afraid to let go. "What is this place?"
"A place of forgetting," said Cruz.
"A prison?" Cruz nodded, as though reluctant to expound on the grim purpose behind the nameless fortress. "An unkind place," said Loken, taking in the featureless walls and bleak institutional grimness. "Not a place to which the ideals of the Imperium easily cling."
"Perhaps not," agreed Cruz, "but only the young and naive believe wars can be won without such places. And, to my lasting regret, I am neither."
"None of us are, Yakton," said Loken. "But why do we find you here?" Cruz hesitated, and Loken saw his eyes dart in the direction of Tisiphone, the great double-edged sword hanging across his back.
"Did you bring them?" asked Cruz.
"All but one," answered Loken, curious as to why Cruz had ignored his question.
"Who didn't you get?"
"Severian," Cruz nodded.
"He was always going to be the hardest to convince. Well, our mission just went from almost impossible to nigh suicidal."
"I think that's the part he objected to."
"He always was a clever man," said Cruz.
"You knew him?" asked Loken, and instantly regretted it when he saw a distant look enter Cruz's eyes.
"I fought alongside the 25th Company on Dahinta," said Cruz.
"The Overseers," said Loken, remembering the hard-fought campaigns to cleanse the derelict cities of scavenger machines. "Aye, it was Severian that got us past the circuit defences of the Silicate Palace to the inner precincts of the Archdroid," said Cruz.
"He saved us months of grinding attrition. I remember when he first brought word of the..."
Loken was well used to Yakton Cruz's wandering reminiscences, but this was not the time to indulge his fondness for old Legion history. "We should be going," he said, before Cruz could go any further.
"Aye, you're right, lad," agreed Cruz with a sigh. "The sooner I'm away from this damned place, the better. Necessity is all well and good, but that doesn't make what we do in its name any easier."
Loken turned to board the Tarnhelm, but Cruz made no move to follow him.
"Yakton?" "This won't be easy for you, Garviel," said Cruz.
Instantly alert, Loken said,
"What won't?" "There's someone here who needs to speak with you."
"To me? Who?" Cruz inclined his head towards the red-armoured jailers who snapped to attention in escort formation.
"She asked for you by name, lad," said Cruz.
"Who did?" repeated Loken.
"Best you see for yourself."
Of all the hells Loken had seen and imagined, few compared to the bleak desolation and hopelessness of this orbital prison. Every aspect of its design appeared calculated to crush the human spirit, from the grim institutional mundanity of its appearance to the oppressive gloom that offered no respite or any hope that its occupants would ever see open skies again. Cruz had boarded the Tarnhelm, leaving him in the custody of the fortress's jailers. They moved with precision and appeared to care little for the fact that he was a warrior of the legions. To them, he was just another detail to be factored into their security protocols. They marched him through vaulted corridors of dark iron and echoing chambers that still bore faint traces of blood and feces no amount of cleaning fluid could ever scrub away. The route was not direct, and several times Loken was sure they had doubled back over their course, following a twisting path deeper into the heart of the fortress. His escorting jailers were trying to disorient him, make him lose any sense of which way they might have come or in which direction lay the exit. A tactic that might work on ordinary prisoners, already half-broken and desperate, but one that was wasted on a legionary with an eidetic sense of direction. As they marched down a winding screw stair, Loken tried to imagine who could be incarcerated here that might have asked for him by name. It should have been easy. Cruz had said she, and he knew few females. Legion life was an overtly masculine environment, though the Imperium cared little for the sex of the soldiers that made up its armies, flew its starships and facilitated its operation. Most of the women he'd met were dead, so maybe this was someone who'd since learned of his existence. A sister or mother, or perhaps even the daughter of someone he'd once known. He heard distant screams and the soft echo of weeping. The sounds had no obvious source, and Loken had the unsettling impression of years of misery so intense they had imprinted on the walls themselves. His guardians eventually led him to a barred chamber suspended over a vault of complete darkness. A number of passageways led from the chamber, each narrow enough for a mortal, but almost claustrophobic for a warrior of his stature. They moved along the rightmost corridor, and Loken detected the unmistakable stench of human flesh and ingrained filth and sweat. But most of all, he smelled despair. His escort stopped at a cell secured by a heavy iron door marked with alphanumerics and what looked like some kind of lingua technis. It meant nothing to him, as he suspected was the point. Everything about this place was designed to be unfamiliar and unwelcoming. A lock disengaged, and the door rose into the frame with a clockwork ratcheting sound, though none of the guards had touched it. Remote contact with a centralized control room, most likely. The guards stood aside, and Loken didn't waste any words on them, ducking beneath the lintel and stepping within. Almost no light penetrated the cell, only diffuse reflections from the corridor outside, but that was more than enough for Loken to make out the outline of a kneeling figure. Loken was no expert on the female form, but the figure's loose robes gave little in its shape to distinguish it. A head turned towards him at the sound of the door opening, and Loken saw something familiar in its faintly elongated occipital structure. A faint buzzing sound came from the high ceiling, and a humming fluorescent lumen disc sparked to life. It flickered for a few seconds before the freshly rooted power stabilized. At first, Loken thought this was a hallucination or another vision of someone long dead. But when she spoke, it was the voice he knew from the many hours they had spent in remembrance. He remembered her as being small, even though most mortals were small to him. Her skin had been so black he'd wondered if it had been dyed, but the sickly light of the lumen disc made it seem somehow grey. Her skull was hairless, made ovoid by cranial implants. She smiled, the expression faltering and unfamiliar. Loken guessed it had been a long time since she had had need of those particular muscles.
"Hello, Captain Loken,"
said Mercedes Oliton. Hacked from the rock of the mountains long before the First Legion built the Citadel of Dawn, the Hall of Flames was a raked amphitheatre of rulership. In the long centuries since then, a vault had been built around the amphitheatre, a fortress around the vault, and a city around the fortress. Much had changed on Molech since then, but the hall retained much of its original purpose. The firstborn scions of House Divine were still ritually burned here, and the planet's rulers still made decisions affecting the lives of millions here. It was, however, no longer a place where mechanized warriors settled their honor duels with fights to the death. Right now, Raven almost wished it was. A hail of stubber fire from Banelash would make short work of the squabbling representatives and silence their strident voices. As pleasant a fantasy as that was, Raven took a deep breath and tried to pay attention to what was going on around him. Enthroned at the centre of the amphitheatre, Raven held the bull-headed scepter, said to have been borne by the Stormlord himself. The artifact was certainly ancient, but that anything could have survived thousands of years without blemish seemed unlikely. He dragged his focus back to the 500 men and women filling the tiered chamber, the senior military officers of Molech, aides, scriveners, calculus logi, savants, and ensigns surrounded them like acolytes, and Raven was reminded of Shagali Shi and his serpent cult devotees. Castor Alcade and three grim-faced ultramarines sat on the stone benches at floor level across from Vitus Salikar. He too was not alone, with a blood angel in red gold to his left, another in black to his right. Tyana Kurion, Lord General of the Grand Army of Molech, sat motionless in the centre of the next tier in her dress greens, stoic and grim. Colonels from a dozen regiments gathered around her like moths drawn to a beneficent flame. Raven didn't know them, but recognized Kurion's immediate subordinates. The heads of the four operational theatres were each seated beneath a sigil denoting one of the cardinal compass points. Clad in her signature drake scale burnous and golden eye mask was Marshal Edoraki Hakon of the Northern Oceanic, and sat along from her was Colonel Oscar von Valkenburg of the Western Marches, whose uniform looked as though he'd slept in it for a month. Commander Abdi Kedar of the Kushite Eastings wore full body armour as though she expected to fight her way back through the jungles to her posting. And finally, the Khan of the Southern Steppe, Corwen Malbec, sat cross-legged with a long sword and rifle balanced across his knees. Behind the four commanders sat hundreds of colonels, majors and captains of the various regiments of the Imperial Army, each clad in their battle-dress armour. The sheer variety of uniforms had the effect of making the gathered soldiery look like revellers in a gaudy carnival. Until now, Raven hadn't quite grasped just how many regiments were garrisoned on Molech. His mother and Lix were in the great gallery above, already in bitter disagreement over the course he should take. Lix spoke of the vision she'd had the night of Raven's becoming, of how his actions would decide the course of a great war fought on Molech. Both claimed the power of foresight, but neither could say with any certainty what those actions would be or in whose favour he would turn the war. Was he to align with Horus, and in so doing be granted dominion of the systems around Molech? Or was it his destiny to fight the War Master and win glory and repute in his defeat? Both roads offered hope of fulfilling his sister's prophetic vision, but which to choose? In addition to the ground forces, Molech boasted a sizable naval presence with a fleet of over 60 vessels, including 8 capital ships and numerous frigates less than 100 years old. Lord Admiral Brython Semper appeared to be asleep, though such a feat was surely impossible in so noisy an environment. Uniformed ratings took notes for him, but Raven suspected Semper would never read them. He had no interest in ground-pounding warfare. If the War Master's forces reached Molech's surface, he would already be lost to the void. Seated apart from the branches of conventional warriors were the Mechanicum contingents, brooding figures swathed in a mix of reds and blacks, who each kept to their own little enclaves. Raven knew more than most of the Mechanicum, but even that was rumour and second-hand gossip, culled from his spies among the sacristans. In the position of prime importance stood the Mechanicum being designated Bellona Modwen of the Ordo Reductor. The senior Martian adept was fully encased in gloss-green cybernetic body armour that made her look like a seated sarcophagus. The sinister mech warrior cohorts of Thalax were hers to command, as was a fearsome array of war machines, tanks and unknowable technologies locked in the catacombs of Mount Torgair. Her magi trained the sacristans and kept the knights functional. As such, the Martian priesthood was a substantial power block on Molech and had the right to attend every military conclave, though they seldom exercised that right. The Mechanicum and the fleet might be keeping their own counsel, but the junior officers of the army were making up for their absent voices. They loudly hectored the speakers below them, either in complete agreement or to drown out what they saw as rank stupidity. Raven couldn't decide which. Current right of voice belonged to the warmonger of Legio Fortidus, an Amazonian-looking woman in an oil-stained khaki body glove named Ur-Nammu. In heavy-accented Gothic, she set out the position of her legio, which to Raven's ears ran thusly. Princeps Uta Dagon and Uta Lerna would not endorse any plan that didn't involve charging the titans of Legio Fortidus straight at the enemy the instant they landed. Opinicus, the invocatio of Legio Griffonicus, held the view that just because the rest of the Legio Fortidus had been wiped out on Mars was no reason for the rest of them to throw themselves on the swords of self-sacrifice. As Raven understood it, both Ur-Nammu and Opinicus undertook roughly the same role within their legios, a form of ambassador between the inhuman Titan precepts and those they must perforce fight alongside. Their bickering was pointless, for Carthal Ashur, the cruelly handsome Calator Martialis of Legio Crucius, had yet to speak. The lesser ambassadors would eventually defer to him, for the largest Titan on Moloch was a Crucius engine, the ancient colossus known as Paragon of Terror. Ashur carried the authority of the Princeps Magnus, Etana Colonis, and if she'd been roused from her war dreams beneath Iron Fist Mountain, then the smaller legios would undoubtedly fall into line behind her. The ambassadors of the legios eventually finished speaking, and deliberations moved on to logistical matters, the establishment of supply lines, ordnance depots, and stockpiling. Raven's threshold for boredom, already stretched thin by the hours of debate, was pushed to breaking point by long recitations of supply levels. A dozen exactor clerks had already spoken, and dozens more stood in line to be heard. Raven rose from his throne and hammered the scepter on the stone floor of the hall, eliciting fearful gasps from the reliquary keepers. He drew his pistol and aimed it at the nearest scrivener and his parchment-spewing data slate.
"You shut up, right now," he said, his drawing of the weapon cutting through the droning account of las rifle power cell shortages at the Kushite preceptory line. "All of you listen very carefully to what I am about to say. I will shoot the next scribe who dares to read an inventory list or stock level right through the head." The clerks lowered their data slates and shuffled uncomfortably in place.
"That's what I thought," said Raven.
"Right. Will someone tell me something of actual bloody importance? Please?"
Castor Alcade of the Ultramarines stood and said,
"What sort of thing are you looking to hear, Lord Divine? This is how wars are fought, with properly emplaced lines of supply and a fully functioning infrastructure in place to support the frontline forces. If you want to hold this world against the War Master, then these are the things you need to know."
"No," said Raven.
"They're the things you need to know. All I need to know is where I will ride into battle. I have an army of scriveners, quartermasters, and savants to deal with numbers and lists." "The 500 worlds are burning," snapped Alcade. "Yet my ultramarines stand ready to fight and die for a world not their own. Speak like that again, and I'll take every warrior back to Ultramar."
"The Emperor himself tasked your legion and the Blood Angels with the defense of Moloch," said Raven with a mocking smile. "You would forsake that duty? I don't think so."
"You would be wise not to test that theory," warned Alcade.
"I am the rightful ruler of Moloch," snapped Raven. "Military command of this world falls to me. And if I learned anything from my father, may he rest in peace, it's that a ruler needs to surround himself with the best people he can, delegate authority, and then not interfere."
"An imperial commander can delegate authority," said Alcade, "but never responsibility."
Raven struggled to control his anger, feeling it twist in his chest like a poisoned blade.
"My house has ruled Moloch for generations," he said with cold hostility. "I know the meaning of responsibility."
Alcade shook his head.
"I'm not sure you do, Lord Divine. Responsibility is a unique concept. You can share it with others, but your portion is not diminished. You may delegate it, but it is still with you. Blood has given you command of Moloch, and its security is your responsibility. No evasion or willful avoidance of that fact can shift it to others."
Raven forced a mask of composure to settle upon his features and nodded as though accepting the legate's patronizing words as wisdom.
"Your words carry the acumen of your Primarch," he said, each word filling his belly with cankerous venom. "I will, of course, review the recommendations of the tithe-takers in due course, but perhaps this is a time for war stratagems rather than dry lists of numbers and dispute between allies."
Alcade nodded and bowed in wary agreement.
"Indeed so, Lord Divine," said Alcade, sitting back down.
Raven let out a poisoned breath that felt like it was scorching his throat. He fixed his gaze on Brython Semper, taking a moment to compose himself and giving the Lord Admiral's aide time to elbow him in the ribs.
"Admiral Semper, can you tell us how long we have before the War Master's forces reach Moloch?"
dressed in a regal purple frock coat of baroque ornamentation, Brython Semper stood and fastened his top button. The Lord Admiral's hair was silver white and pulled into a long scalp lock, his face a scarred, partially augmetic mask.
"Of course, my lord," he said, in loading the contents of his aide's data slate to his ocular implant. "The astropathic choirs send word of impending arrivals of scores of vessels, perhaps as many as 40 or 50 in total. Nor are the approaching craft making any secret of their arrival. I'm getting all sorts of nonsense about astropaths, hearing wolves howling in the warp and ships screaming their designations. More than likely it's some form of imperial distortion or simply reflected vox transmissions, but it's clear the War Master wants us to know he's coming. Though if he thinks we're a bunch of cowards who run screaming at the first sign of the enemy, he's in for a rude awakening."
Vitus Salicar interrupted the Lord Admiral before he could continue.
"It would be a mistake to think that just because you outnumber the War Master's fleet, you hold the upper hand. Legion Void War is a savage, merciless thing."
Semper bowed to the Blood Angel and said,
"I know full well how dangerous the Space Marines are, Captain."
"You don't," said Salicar sadly. "We are killers, reapers of flesh. You must never forget that."
Before the Lord Admiral could respond to the Blood Angel's melancholic tone, Raven said,
"How soon will the enemy be here?"
Visibly struggling to contain his temper in the face of Salicar's dismissal of his fleet's capabilities, Semper spoke slowly and carefully.
"The Master of Astropath's best estimate is a real space breach any day now, putting them within reach of Molech in around 2 weeks. I've already issued a muster order to pull our picket ships back from the system's edge."
"You won't engage the traitors in open space?"
"Since I am not in the habit of throwing away the lives of my crews, no, I will not," said Semper. "As Captain Salicar helpfully pointed out, the warships of the Space Marines are not to be underestimated, so our best course of action is to dispatch a provocateur force to goad the traitors onto the horns of our orbital guns. Our main fleet will remain within the umbra of the orbital batteries on the Kármán line. Between the hammer and anvil of our static guns and the war fleet, we can gut the traitor ships before they can land so much as a single warrior."
Despite his bombastic tone, Raven liked the cut of Semper's jib and nodded.
"Do it, Admiral," he said. "Dispatch the provocateur force and wish them good hunting."
The cell had no furniture, not even a bed. A thin mattress lay folded in one corner, together with a chipped night soil pot and a small box, like a presentation case for a medal.
"You look like you've seen a ghost,"
said Mercedes, rising from her kneeling position. Loken's mouth opened, but no sounds came out. This was the second dead person he'd seen, but this one was flesh and blood. She was here. Mercedes Oleton, his personal remembrancer. She was alive, here, now. She wasn't the same, though. The harsh light revealed faded scars tracing looping arcs over the sides and upper surfaces of her diminished skull. Surgical scars. Excisions. She saw him looking and said,
"They took out my embedded memory coils. All the images and all the remembrances I stored. All gone. All I have left of them are my organic memories, and even they're beginning to fade."
"I left you on the vengeful spirit," said Loken. "I thought you must be dead."
"I would be, if it wasn't for Yacton," replied Mercedes.
"Yacton? Yacton Cruz?"
"Yes. He saved us from the murder of the remembrancers and got us off the ship," said Mercedes. "He didn't tell you?"
"No," said Loken. "He didn't."
"We escaped with Yacton and Captain Garrow."
"You were on the Eisenstein,"
said Loken, disbelief and wonder competing for his full attention. Cruz had said little of the perilous journey from Istvan, but neglecting to mention Mercedes' survival beggared belief.
"And I wasn't the only one Yacton saved."
"What do you mean?"
"Euphrates got off the vengeful spirit. Kirill, too."
"Cinderman and Keela are alive?"
Mercedes nodded.
"As far as I know. But before you ask, I don't know where they are. I haven't seen either of them in years.
Loken paced the interior of the cell, raw emotion surging like a chaotic tide within him. Cinderman had been a dear friend to him, a mentor of superlative intellect, and a confidant of sorts, a bridge between transhuman sensibilities and mortal concerns. That Keeler had also survived was a miracle, for the Imagist had a real knack for getting herself into trouble.
"You didn't know she was alive?"
asked Mercedes. "No," said Loken.
"You've heard of the saint?"
Loken shook his head. "No. What saint?"
"You have been out of the loop, haven't you?"
Loken paused, angry and confused. She was not to blame, but she was here. He wanted to lash out, but released a shuddering breath that seemed to expel a heavy weight of bilious humours. "I was dead, I think," he said at last. "For a while, or as good as dead. Maybe I was just lost. So very lost."
"But you came back," said Mercedes, reaching out to take his hand. "They brought you back because you're needed."
"So I'm told," said Loken wearily, curling his fingers around hers, careful not to squeeze too hard. They stood unmoving, neither willing to break the silence or the shared intimacy. Her skin was soft, reminding Loken of a fleeting moment in his life, when he had been young and innocent, when he had loved and been loved in return, when he had been human. Loken sighed and released Mercedes' hand. "I have to get you out of here," he said.
"You can't,"
she said, withdrawing her hand. "I'm one of Malkador's chosen," said Loken. "I'll send word to the Sigilite and have you taken back to Terra. I'm not letting you rot away in here another minute."
"Carviel,"
said Mercedes, and her use of his given name stopped him in his tracks.
"They're not going to let me out of here. Not for now, at least. I spent a long time in the heart of the War Master's flagship. People have been executed for a lot less."
"I'll vouch for you," said Loken. "I'll guarantee your loyalty." Mercedes shook her head and folded her arms.
"If you didn't know who I was, if you hadn't shared your life with me, would you want someone like me released? If I was a stranger, what would you do? Turn me loose or keep me imprisoned?"
Loken took a step forward. "I can't just leave you here. You don't deserve this."
"You're right, I don't deserve this. But you don't have a choice," said Mercedes. "You have to leave me."
Her hand reached up to brush the bare metal of his unmarked plate. Thin fingers traced the line of his pauldron and swept across the curve of the shoulder guard.
"It's strange to see you in this armour."
"I no longer have a legion," he said simply, angry at her willful desire to languish in this prison. She nodded.
"They told me you died on Istvan, but I didn't believe them. I knew you were alive."
"You knew I'd survived?"
"I did."
"How?"
"Euphrates told me."
"You said you didn't know where she was."
"I don't."
"Then how?" Mercedes turned away, as though reluctant to give voice to her thoughts for fear of his ridicule. She bent to retrieve the presentation case from the ground next to the mattress. When she turned back to him, he saw her eyes were wet with tears.
"I dreamed of Euphrates," she said. "She told me you'd come here. I know it sounds ridiculous, but after all I've seen and been through, it's almost normal."
The anger drained from Loken, replaced by an echoing sense of helplessness. Mercedes' words touched something deep within him, and he could hear the soft breath of a third person, the ghost of a shadow in a room where none existed.
"It isn't ridiculous," said Loken. "What did she say?"
"She told me to give you this,"
said Mercedes, holding out the case.
"To pass on."
"What is it?"
"Something that once belonged to Yakton Cruz," she said. "Something she said he needs to have again."
Loken took the box but didn't open it.
"She said to remind Yakton that he is the half-heard no longer, that his voice will be heard louder than any other in his legion."
"What does that mean?"
"I don't know," said Mercedes. "It was a dream. It's not like it's an exact science."
Loken nodded, though what he was hearing made little sense. At least as little sense as answering a summons to war on the word of a dead man.
"Did Euphrates say anything else?" he asked.
Mercedes nodded, and the tears brimming on the edge of her eyes, like a river about to break its banks, spilled down her cheeks.
Yes,
sobbed Mercedes.
She said to say goodbye.